might catch such things in fall time, in freezing weather, put in a from a large kill of caribou, or they might have skin rope or other semi-perishable items that were quite precious. They didn't want that for one reason or another. They wanted to leave there, and they would have had to block the cave to keep out wolverines and bears and foxes, wolves. But I think that the hanging caves would be not a barrier to some of them, but it would be to others. I don't know about a wolf getting up there. It seems a little difficult for him. Alunuk, who is an Upper Noatak, said that they used a cave in that area, their area, inland, and they blocked the entrance with a very heavy stone, which I assume that, except they were a superman, or which they were, or a team of men could roll a rock against certain cave openings. There's also, in the use of the caves, there may be also just you want to hide something, some valuables, and you know the cave area very well, and you could pick out some of these collapsed caves or cavities in talus slopes, and it would be a very effective way of hiding things as long as they were immune to, say, damage by ground squirrels, or not likely to be damaged by them, or by, say, wolverines who could maybe squeeze in. We know another winter use of the caves, of course, and that is by hibernating bears and perhaps other animals, predaceous animals, wolverine go in, I don't know. And we know that they do, and we have evidence from the floor, the strata in Cave 9, that bears, according to Dimmock, he said, oh, those, and I think Helya too had heard it before and so recognized it, but where they would bring in a bed of willows and lay them down and cushion them while they're hibernating. Cave 9 seems to be rather exposed, but who knows what a bear might prefer, and also its extent is not as great, could be greater than at present. And Cave 11, as we know, as I'm convinced from the hair evidence, was actually used in the 1940s by brown bears for winter hibernation. Of course, if bears are there in the winter, and people will know that, being so expert in all these facets of their environment, it is possible that they would go and hunt the bears in hibernation, although that is a risky game, but people are and were highly motivated, and some of them highly skilled and lucky. That is certainly an important usage. In springtime, when the bears are out, coming out in April around there, you could get squirrels that were truly hibernators coming out on the hillside there, and you could snare them. And I'm sure at some time somebody must have stopped there for that purpose. There's another thing that was sometimes done, I believe it was in springtime, was breaking of collected leg bones of caribou. And this one very wide rock shelter or cave, the one that I mentioned before, that I messed up, could have been such a place where there are tremendous amounts of leg bones that were split for marrow, and I don't think it could be done by anybody but people, and I would suppose that maybe that was a place where people. They had saved up a bunch of leg bones, and maybe at the caves when they and and at some point in the year they would hammer them and render whatever they did with the marrow, or put it away, and that would be could be, I would think, a woman's job, but I don't know that women would go into the area, because there's sometimes their places are associated with maleness, or at least with male activities, and they may or may not have. That is, women. Ahalya thought that this was strictly a male activity there, and probably that's generally true, but we don't know all the ins and outs of thousands of years. Another activity besides the snaring of squirrels and preparing of marrow, leg bones, of which so many have been split there, would be snaring and deadfalls for predators and raptors. And it, since I don't know how often in that area, we don't know from Deering area, for instance, how often deadfalls were made for brown bears, who are very strong, but it's possible that they could set trigger deadfall with rocks to kill a brown bear, and certainly wolverine and wolves, foxes, other smaller predators. And one might want to have wanted to go there to get amulets from the raptors were known, very well known, to have been collected for as amulets for hunters. There again, these are predominantly male activities, but the squirrel hunting in springtime would be probably a family, or could be partners who walk some distance. Another use of the area, and certainly in times when precipitation is higher than they are at present, we don't know, of course, whether that was true in the period of human occupancy, but anyway, the large willows that grow down around the creek would provide some material for supports for dwellings or elements of improvised boat frames are called kayageak. It is using freshly killed caribou skins, and you could cut some fairly strong, adequately strong willows and make a frame to get out. And now Cottonwood, I don't know how much water is in Cottonwood Creek now, and certainly Trail Creek didn't have much when we were there, but the willows might have been much more luxuriant and available, of course, then they might have been available in other places. Another use of the cave, which sounds trivial but not necessarily in people's thinking, would be as a place to make offerings if there were spiritual creatures who dwelt in the area, which is often true of rocky hillsides and cave areas. People may have come there to make offerings. Most very highly likely would be hunters rather than women, and to leave something for these helping spirits in or around the cave area, or at some of these rock features that had some meaning to them. The willows, too, might have been a source of inner bark, which were quite important, and as my friend Grandpa John Kakarak said, that the most essential of all things were fibers to Eskimos. I think the groups of apparently contemporary arrowheads in Cave 2 were pretty obviously left there as a cache, or those could have been offerings to cave or hillside helping spirits. I've never forgotten what Ivor Scarland said about the Tananaw Valley looking essentially like it did in the Pleistocene, And this continuity, I'm very much set on that, of the continuity that is presented to successive generations of people, given, of course, that certain animals are variable, but that the land, habitats are very long-lived in the Arctic. And they would have found the area may have looked very similar to what it does now as far as vegetation goes, except that some plants were more predominant than others compared to now. I think this is one hindrance that Westerners have. They assume that things were quite different, and of course in some ways they're bound to be, but they don't think in terms of continuity over hundreds and thousands of years. They think of abrupt changes, and in the north there is a tremendous amount of continuity in the Arctic environment. And as a result, there is a tremendous amount of commonality between the needs of somebody 8,000 years ago at Trail Creek and what they were in the 19th century. I want to add some more comments if my tape recorder will allow it. It's been acting up. In periods of heavier snowfall and heavier rain, the willows at possibly alders at Trail Creek and other places around that region would have been much more extensive, since they do depend on their riparian, at least the species that we saw growing there below the Snowbank in 1949 and 50. And therefore, there would have been more materials for native hunters' uses, and there would have been more fuel if people were working in springtime or another season preparing marrow. And as I said, I believe that could well have been women who were doing that. Another thing I was thinking about was the element of time and the sense of time that people who are close to the land have, or limitless time. And I think it's different than somebody with a stopwatch. Once time is gone, but an event has passed, it's in the same league as something 100,000 years ago and a minute ago, barring our memory, they're in the same, they become the same in a sense. And when you are at Trail Creek, you get this sense of immensity and connection. I think this, however, does require from the observer this closeness to the land and to creatures that most Westerners lack. I worked in fish and game for a number of years, and I found that only a small minority of these people involved in the in this enterprise were really intimately connected with the resources which they were supposedly managing or studying and managing. And the same thing would be if somebody goes to caves. Now, since I have connections in my early childhood in rural areas and with stone, limestone, these things all resonate with me, and also that I was interested in biology widely and was interested in almost all facets of nature and was not discouraged from that. It would be different than somebody who had an enthusiasm or an ambition, and the caves were only a vehicle, or the area, or their profession was only a vehicle to an end. And by that, I don't mean to say that Helya wasn't quite aware. He was a very good observer. And also, he was only one generation removed from nature. He was born in the city, but some people now are 3, 4, 5 generations away from any real connection with nature. And moreover, he was a highly adaptive person, as his personal history will show. The history of the caves fascinates me if I think about it, and it has to be taken with a grain of salt by listeners because I haven't read the literature on plant communities and evidence of climate changes with much attention. I haven't had access to them too. However, I know Cave 2 extremely well. I did, and I was familiar with Cave 11. Cave 2 and Cave 9. And in the case of Cave 2, even allowing for soliflexion movement of things down slope, because it had that rather steep bottom profile, and with freezing and thawing, you get this creep that confused things. Despite that, it was quite evident that the oldest material in the cave, which appeared to be these slender grooved items, heads of implements, either thrown or shot with a bow and arrow, and with flint flake side blades, that these were not far from the bottom deposits of the cave. Now, perhaps one can come up with an idea explaining why the cave had very little in it at the time, that it was being flushed out or that it slid out and had been filled, say, and refilled and emptied a number of times during its history, or that it had always remained hollowed out. It was forming without any extensive deposits. If that were the case, why is that so? It befuddles me. In the case of Cave 9, the bottom profile is quite different, and you have this wedge-shaped, long part of the T shape of the Cave 9, shall we say, complex. And in this case, there was, as I recall, also a distribution down to the lowest level of artifacts of human presence, down to the lowest element of the cave, and certainly in the back part of the cave, this the top, the horizontal part of the T with the chimney in it, there was no evidence that I can recall of a lot of flowing out and mixing of things, you know, in as there was in Cave 2, and that the artifacts went down all the way down to the level at which they played out, but still continued elsewhere, I'll put it diplomatically. On the other hand, on the top cave, whatever its number where we camped, on the most southerly of the high caves, it was obvious that it had gone through an evolution, or seemed to be, when we dug the test hole down in this collapsed portion, that there was no evidence whatever of a human presence, at least in the turn of, there had not been in terms of stones where we dug. And this was a pretty good sized pit, unfortunately, probably. The wide-mouthed shelter, rock shelter, or cave, as you may call it, somewhat shallow, going back into the rock face, and wide that I've talked about, and the one that I overlooked an artifact in when I test dug it. That one must certainly shows the presence of a lot of people and splitting a lot of caribou marrow bones, and perhaps with a careful study, excavation of the whole thing, you would find other species, including something like bison or horse. And this cave, being much farther down than the top cave, near the creek, had pretty good access to water and willows if they were, say, were doing any boiling of marrow bones or cooking there at the time. I do also want to point out when I said something about leaving offerings, I spoke of spirits as being helping spirits. That might be a little confusing because there were spirits of hillsides and places that were not like shamans helping spirits, as far as I know. It's sometimes used in that respect, but they were something that would give either placation of them or appeal to them would give you success in hunting. And that was what I was thinking of. The way that this was expressed in Eastern Kotzebue-san was by driving little, poking little sticks into the walls of a cave or a place and hanging offerings from them. At Trail Creek, I saw one stick that had been thrust into the a small rock wall or little, or maybe only as high as a person or less, with the vegetation growing over part of it, down near the end of the canyon or the creek when it turns, it heads down toward Cottonwood Creek. And there, this was rather remarkably stuck into the rocks, and it was not some willow that had grown there. It was a fairly large diameter stick that had been thrust in. And I believe at the time, Hay and I discussed it, and either he or I or both thought a raven may have done it. And I don't see the agency such as Wind of having done it. I don't recall any sticks thrust into crevices in the caves, but I didn't make a thorough look for that in these shelters, and some that would not provide. And then, of course, there are these collapsed areas that I mentioned in the Talus slopes that would appear perhaps to hide or to represent fallen, jumbled elements of caves. And so it's a good chance that they did leave offerings. The raptors, of course, were nesting there. The notes show these rough-legged hawks were nesting there in 1949 and 50, and we have pictures of them. So that's no question about that. And the falcons were, I don't know where they nested, but they were regularly around the creek there. I've had a recent correspondence with Ernest S. Birch Jr., Tiger Birch, about my ideas of, concerning or lack of strong belief or confidence in the idea of boundaries in Eskimo, between Eskimo groups, Inupiat. And this is because I've never heard anybody dwell on that, and it seems so counter to Inupiat thought that you would have a line of rock set up and a boundary line. Not that there wasn't antagonism sometimes, but on the peninsula and around Kotzebue Sound generally, there are only a few instances historically where there were in those societies are right on the sound, certainly, and even on the peninsula, as far as I know, where there was marked hostility between people sharing similar habitats. And I don't think that these boundaries are set things, and maybe they don't even exist. I didn't ask questions like this because it would be not only not visualizing, because I was aware of this idea about boundaries that had been put on maps, but if you ask people this, that you tend to get questions, you answered your questions that will substantiate what you, in your mind, what you're asking them, because they may want, I don't know what the word is, to please you, but maybe they're confused and they sort of agree with you because they want to sort of get through the subject. and get into something that is a bit more understandable to them. And I've never heard of anything like this. Well, they say, well, this is somebody's campsite, and it goes up to here and there, only in the sense, as I had said before, perhaps on the tapes of fish dams and these fish netting sites where there was a need for structures and for operations, and those were only while people were utilizing them. And then you might say rights or ownership, sort of a vague ownership, disappeared. And when that site was vacated for any length of time, somebody else took over, whether or not they were, I would assume, whether or not they were closely related, and of course family lines would die out. So I'm very highly skeptical, and when you look around Seward Peninsula and the inland there, you get up on a ridge, it's open country, and what would be limiting you would be limited by your transportation abilities and your the resources, I believe, rather than some line on a map. And these zones or these so-called borders, you know, that are drawn there, I think would be merely, if they have validity, would just be the farthest as people could work an area with their given technology, you know, because they have to have a base. Ultimately, they have a family group, and their radius of action will take them so far, and to some extent, there would be a lack of conflict just because people have only so much possibility of radius of action. And moreover, since people group together, they tend to, and in your pit, and probably people far, far back were very, very much want to be in a group, and the advantage of being in a group for certain activities and for mutual support generally. So this pulls them back to sort of a core place, and they're still stuck with how far they can work from that family center. And if they take the families out, they're limited the number of places they can go by the resources and terrain. So I'm highly dubious. When you sit up there on Trail Creek and look out, you can say, well, that was the border. Over here was the border of that butte or something, and that was the line between, the Kavera Mute and the Ipnat Chira Mute, Deering people, or whatever you want to call them. I doubt it. I don't like the idea. The other thing I've touched upon, and I think it's still worth mentioning, is that people learned a lot just by observing. And when you see corbel arches and you see domes, things, these they actually saw in nature. When you go into a cave, you see a dome, and it's maybe highly fractured, and the rocks are all holding each other together. And the similarity between that and a dome snow house is quite obvious, and was obvious to them. Them being people way, way, way back, and you also see rocks coming together in corbelled arches where they're angled up and then rest against or sort of the keystone, whatever these are called technically. Those are abundant, and you see them recreated. We did over at Skeleton Butte in this year, 1995, and I saw what would appear to be a placed corbel arch there, and not just an accident. So observing of nature would be a wonderful teacher, and even when people die out, they can relearn, plus the things they find, the tools and the remnants they find, of course, is another source. But just simply observing nature provides for tremendous continuity and recovery from population losses and knowledge losses, although some of those are very great, say in the areas of language, I'm sure, and has been at times in the past. I want to comment, too, that Hellyard died in 1984, then and his bones will probably be moved into some, I suppose, mass gathering of bones about now or soon. He told me that in Denmark, you're buried and then you're dug up in 12 or 13 years, something like that. That's the thought about this. Sort of reminds me of Bones in the Caves and Helia's bones and Gerda's being moved to some pile. That's the way we go, isn't it? And he thought that the American system of treating the dead was very exotic, very strange, very primitive. Only is it only politicians and kings get that treatment in Denmark. You know, being stuffed full of chemicals to keep them from rotting.